This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Plan of Attack by Bob Woodward. Read by Boyd Gaines.
I interviewed President Bush on the record for more than 3.5 hours over 2 days, December 10th and 11th, 2003. I also interviewed Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld on the record for more than 3 hours in the fall of 2003. Information in the book comes from more than 75 key people directly involved in the events, including War Cabinet members, the White House staff, and officials serving at various levels of the State and Defense Departments, and the Central Intelligence Agency. When thoughts, judgments, or feelings are attributed to participants, I have obtained these from the person directly, a colleague with firsthand knowledge, or the written record. In addition, I used nicknames for undercover CIA operatives to protect their identities. The decision-making leading to the Iraq War, concentrated in 16 months from November 2001 to March 2003, is probably the best window into understanding who George W. Bush is, how he operates, and what he cares about. President George W. Bush clamped his arm on his Secretary of Defense, Donald H. Rumsfeld, as a National Security Council meeting in the White House Situation Room was just finishing on Wednesday, November 21, 2001. It was the day before Thanksgiving, just 72 days after the 9/11 terrorist attacks and the beginning of the 11th month of Bush's presidency. "I need to see you," the president said to Rumsfeld. The two men went into one of the small cubbyhole offices adjacent to the Situation Room, closed the door, and sat down. "I want you," the president began, and as is often the case, he restarted his sentence. "What kind of a war plan do you have for Iraq? How do you feel about the war plan for Iraq?" Rumsfeld said he didn't think the Iraq war plan was current. "I'm concerned about all of our war plans." He was reviewing all 68 of the department's secret war and other contingency plans worldwide. Bush and Rumsfeld are a contrasting pair. Large and physical, with a deep stare from small brown eyes, Bush, 55 years old, has a quick, joshing manner which at times borders on the impulsive. Rumsfeld, 69, had been elected to his first political office, congressman from the 13th District of Illinois in the Chicago suburbs, 39 years earlier. Small, almost boyishly dashing, with thinning combed back hair, Rumsfeld was intense and also focused as he squinted through his trifocals. Rumsfeld explained to Bush that the process of drafting war plans was so complex that it took years. The present war plans tended to hold assumptions that were stale, and they failed miserably to account for the fact that a new administration with different goals had taken over. "Let's get started on this," Bush recalled saying, "and get Tommy Franks looking at what it would take to protect America by removing Saddam Hussein if we have to." General Franks was the combatant commander for the region. Bush also asked, "Could this be done on a basis that would not be terribly noticeable?" "Sure, because I'm doing all of them," Rumsfeld replied. His worldwide review would provide perfect cover. The president had another request. "Don't talk about what you're doing with others." "Yes, sir," Rumsfeld said, "but it's particularly important that I talk to George Tenet." CIA Director Tenet would be critical to intelligence gathering and any coordinated covert efforts in Iraq. Fine, the president said, indicating that at a future date, Tenet and others could become involved, but not now. 2 years later, in interviews, Bush said he did not want others in on the secret because a leak would trigger enormous international angst and domestic speculation. I knew what would happen if people thought we were developing a potential or a war plan for Iraq. The Bush-Rumsfeld-Franks work remained secret for months. Knowledge of this work would have ignited a firestorm, the president knew. It was such a high-stakes moment, and when people had this sense of war followed on the heels of the Afghan decision, Bush's order for a military operation into Afghanistan in response to 9/11, it would look like that I was anxious to go to war, and I'm not anxious to go to war. He insisted, war is my absolute last option. At the same time, Bush said, he realized that the simple act of setting Rumsfeld in motion on Iraq war plans might be the first step in taking the nation to a war with Saddam Hussein. Absolutely, Bush recalled. What he perhaps had not realized was that war plans and the process of war planning become policy by their own momentum, especially with the intimate involvement of both the Secretary of Defense and the President. The story of Bush's decisions leading up to the Iraq War is a chronicle of continual dilemmas, since the President was pursuing two simultaneous policies. He was planning for war, and he was conducting diplomacy aiming to avoid war. At times, the war planning aided the diplomacy. At many other points, it contradicted it. From the conversation in the cubbyhole off the Situation Room that day, Rumsfeld realized how focused Bush was about Iraq. He should have, the president recalled. Rumsfeld was left with the impression that Bush had not spoken to anyone else. That was not so. That same morning, the president had told Condoleezza Rice, his national security advisor, that he was planning to get Rumsfeld to work on Iraq. For Rice, 9/11 had put Iraq on the back burner. The president did not explain to her why he was returning to it now, or what triggered his orders to Rumsfeld. In the interviews, the president said he could not recall if he had talked to Vice President Dick Cheney before he took Rumsfeld aside. But he was certainly aware of Cheney's own position. The vice president, after 9/11, clearly saw Saddam Hussein as a threat to peace, he said, and was unwavering in his view that Saddam was a real danger. On the long walk up to war in Iraq, Dick Cheney was a powerful, steamrolling force. Since the terrorist attacks, he had developed an intense focus on the threats posed by Saddam and by Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda network, the group responsible for 9/11. It was seen as a fever by some of his colleagues, even a disquieting obsession. For Cheney, taking care of Saddam was high necessity. The nation was on edge in November 2001, still in shock from the 9/11 attacks. Already, U.S.-supported forces controlled half of Afghanistan. In an effective display of American technology, the CIA, with millions of dollars and years of covert contacts among Afghan tribes, plus U.S. military Special Forces commando teams directing precision bombing, seemed to have turned the tide of war in a matter of weeks. It was a time of both danger and intoxication for Bush, his war cabinet, his generals, and the country. When he was back at the Pentagon, Rumsfeld immediately had the joint staff begin drafting a top-secret message to General Franks requesting a commander's estimate, a new take on the status of the Iraq war plan, and what Franks thought could be done to improve it. Franks, 56, had served in the Army since he was 20, a Vietnam and 1991 Gulf War veteran. At 6'3", with a gentle Texas drawl, he could get hot real fast and had a reputation as an officer who would scream at his subordinates. At the same time, he was a bit of a maverick reformer who at times deplored the leaden, unimaginative ways of the military. It had been a brutal 72 days since 9/11 for Franks. There had been not even a bare-bones war plan for Afghanistan. Rumsfeld had been the strongest proponent of boots on the ground, a commitment of U.S. military ground forces. But the first boots on the ground had been a CIA paramilitary team on September 27th, just 16 days after the terrorist attacks. This had driven Rumsfeld to the brink. "I don't understand," Rumsfeld had said. "Why can't we do this?" Soon the secretary was trickling down into lower-level operational decisions, demanding details and explanations. According to Franks's contemporaneous account to others, he had told Rumsfeld, "Mr. Secretary, stop. This ain't gonna work. You can fire me. I'm either the commander or I'm not, and you've got to trust me or you don't. And if you don't, I need to go somewhere else." Rumsfeld's version: "There is no doubt but that at the beginning we had to find our way." Rumsfeld, the former college wrestler, appreciated someone confident enough to push back and lay it on the line from a subordinate position, maybe even take him down, throw him on the mat for a moment. They agreed to try to work as a team. Firing the general in charge at the onset of a war on terrorism would, in any practical sense, be difficult. After the CIA and military campaign in Afghanistan looked successful, Rumsfeld declared that Franks was his man. To reports of lingering tensions, Franks said much later, "Bullshit. He was pushing, and it satisfied me greatly." The same pre-Thanksgiving Wednesday that Bush sent Rumsfeld on the mission about the Iraq war plan, Air Force Major General Victor E. Jean Renouart, Jr., the director of operations for General Franks at Central Command, headquartered in Tampa, Florida, was in the thick of organizing and monitoring military movements and attacks in the Afghanistan war, 5,000 miles and 9.5 time zones away. Renouart, 51, a balding, brainy fighter pilot with a master's degree in psychology, was the man who knitted it all together for Franks. The thick bound volumes in which he took down notes from endless meetings and extensive lists of tasks to be performed were multiplying. Renouart's executive assistant called each latest volume the Black Book of Death, because the mounting number of tasks had become a killer. Renouart picked up a call on a secure line from the Pentagon coming in from his counterpart there, Marine Lieutenant General Gregory S. Newbold. Newbold was the liaison with the combatants and a reliable pipeline for what was stirring. "Hey," Newbold said in his best take-notice voice, "I've got a real tough problem for you. The secretary's going to ask you to start looking at your Iraq planning in great detail and give him a new commander's estimate." "You've got to be shitting me," Renouart said. The current Iraq war plan, Op Plan 1003, was some 200 pages with 20-plus annexes numbering another 600 pages on logistics, intelligence, air, land, and sea operations. According to this plan, it would take the United States roughly 7 months to move a force of 500,000 to the Middle East before launching military operations. Renouart went to see General Franks, who was incredulous. They were in the midst of one war, Afghanistan, and now they wanted detailed planning for another, Iraq? "God damn," Franks said. "What the fuck are they talking about?" In early January 2001, before George W. Bush was inaugurated, Vice President-elect Dick Cheney passed a message to the outgoing Secretary of Defense, William S. Cohen, a moderate Republican who served in the Democratic Clinton administration. "We really need to get the president-elect briefed up on some things," Cheney said, adding that he wanted a serious discussion about Iraq and different options. Topic A should be Iraq. On Wednesday morning, January 10th, 10 days before the inauguration, Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rice, and the designated Secretary of State, Colin L. Powell, went to the Pentagon to meet with Cohen. Afterward, Bush and his team went downstairs to the tank, the secure domain and meeting room for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Bush sauntered in like Cool Hand Luke, flapping his arms slightly, cocky, but seeming also ill at ease. Two generals briefed them on the state of the no-fly zone enforcement in Iraq. Since the Gulf War, the United States enforced two designated no-fly zones, which comprised about 60% of the country. The Iraqis could fly neither planes nor helicopters in these areas. President-elect Bush asked some practical questions about how things worked, but he did not offer nor hint at his desires. A peppermint was at each place. Bush unwrapped his and popped it into his mouth. Later, he eyed Cohen's mint and flashed a pantomime query, "Do you want that?" Cohen signaled no, so Bush reached over and took it. Near the end of the hour and a quarter briefing, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, Army General Henry Hugh Shelton, noticed Bush eyeing his mint, so he passed it over. Cheney listened, but he was tired and closed his eyes, conspicuously nodding off several times. Rumsfeld, who was sitting at a far end of the table, paid close attention, though he kept asking the briefers to please speak up or please speak louder. "We're off to a great start," one of the chiefs commented privately to a colleague after the session. "The vice president fell asleep, and the secretary of defense can't hear." Cohen, who was leaving the Defense Department in 10 days, predicted the new team would soon back off and find reconciliation with Saddam, who he felt was effectively contained and isolated. In interviews nearly 3 years later, Bush said of the pre-9/11 situation, "I was not happy with our policy." It wasn't having much impact on changing Saddam's behavior or toppling him. Prior to September 11, however, a president could see a threat and contain it or deal with it in a variety of ways without fear of that threat materializing on our own soil. Saddam was not yet a top priority. Bush received a second critical national security briefing a few days later. CIA Director George Tenet and his deputy for operations, James L. Pavitt, gave Bush, Cheney, and Rice the so-called secrets briefing. Tenet and Pavitt agreed there were three major threats to American national security. One was Osama bin Laden and his al-Qaeda terrorist network. A second major threat was the increasing proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, WMD, chemical, biological, and nuclear. Third was the rise of China, especially its military, but that problem was 5 to 15 or more years away. Iraq was barely mentioned. On the 17th day of the Bush presidency, Monday, February 5th, Rice chaired a principals committee meeting that included Cheney, Powell, and Rumsfeld. Deputy CIA Director John E. McLaughlin substituted for Tenet. The purpose was to review Iraq policy, the status of diplomatic, military, and covert options. At least on paper, the United Nations had an economic sanctions policy directed at Saddam's regime. Another issue was the weapons inspections inside Iraq that the UN had authorized after the Gulf War to establish that Saddam no longer possessed weapons of mass destruction. In 1998, Saddam had forced the inspectors out, and the question was what might be done to get them back in. No one had a good answer. What should be the approach to Iraqi opposition groups both outside and inside Iraq? Again, no one had a complete answer. Rice asked for a review of the no-fly zones. What was their purpose? What were the costs and risks? The benefits. Bush himself worried about the no-fly zone enforcement. The odds of Iraq getting lucky and downing a pilot were bound to catch up with him. He later recalled, "I instructed the Secretary of Defense to go back and develop a more robust option in case we really needed to put some serious weapons on Iraq in order to free a pilot." The eventual result was a plan to fly fewer sorties and fly them less predictably to enhance the safety of the pilots. If a plane was shot at, the response would be more strategic, hitting Iraqi military installations important to Saddam. On March 1st, the principals met again, and Powell was given the task of devising a plan and strategy to refocus the UN economic sanctions on weapons control. Rumsfeld and others from defense repeatedly voiced concern about dual-use items, equipment that might seem innocent but could be used or converted to assist Iraq's weapons programs. "Look at what they are buying," Rumsfeld complained to Powell at one point. "They are buying these dump trucks. They can take off the hydraulic cylinder that pushes the truck bed up, and they can use it for a launcher for a rocket. You want to sell them the means to erect rockets to shoot at us or Israel?" "For Christ's sake," Powell said. "If somebody wants a cylinder to erect a rocket, they don't have to buy a $200,000 dump truck to get one." It was unprecedented for someone who had served as Secretary of Defense, or for that matter, any top cabinet post, to come back 25 years later to the same job. It was a chance to play the hand again. Rumsfeld was determined to play it better. But during the first months of his second Pentagon tour, he discovered that the place was more broken than he had anticipated. Discussions on Iraq policy continued at the cabinet level and at the second tier, the so-called Deputies Committee, with Defense Deputy Paul D. Wolfowitz and the number two at State, Richard L. Armitage. The interagency process had yielded up lots of meetings and paper, but no plan and no action toward regime change, the standing policy since 1998, when Congress passed a law that authorized $97 million in military assistance to Iraqi opposition forces. This led to discussions among the principals and deputies about the circumstances under which the U.S. military might be used directly. Powell called this the "suppose we ever have to do this" attack on Iraq to overthrow Saddam. The intellectual godfather and fiercest advocate for toppling Saddam was Paul Wolfowitz, the Deputy Secretary of Defense. A 58-year-old PhD in political science, with long, thick, graying hair and a soft, almost rabbinical manner, Wolfowitz had edgy, hawkish views. The reasons for getting rid of Saddam were: it was necessary, and it would be relatively easy. Wolfowitz believed it was possible to send in the military to overrun and seize Iraq's southern oil fields, 1,000 wells, which had about two-thirds of Iraq's oil production, and establish a foothold. All the wells were within some 60 miles of the Kuwait border. "There's nothing to stop you from seizing it," he declared. The proposal was dubbed the Enclave Strategy. From the enclave, support would be given to the anti-Saddam opposition, which would rally the rest of the country and overthrow the dictator. Powell thought that Wolfowitz was talking as if 25 million Iraqis would rush to the side of a U.S.-supported opposition. In his opinion, it was one of the most absurd, strategically unsound proposals he had ever heard. But Wolfowitz was like a drum that would not stop. And Powell, shaking his head, kept saying, "This is lunacy." It was not clear where the off switch was, or whether there was an off switch, so the Secretary of State sought opportunities to speak directly to the President. "Don't let yourself get pushed into anything until you are ready for it," Powell advised Bush, "or until you think there is a real reason for it. This is not as easy as it is being presented." "Don't worry about it," the president replied. "It's good contingency planning, and I know what they are doing, and I'm in no hurry to go look for trouble." Bush never saw a formal plan for a quick strike, he recalled. "The idea may have floated around as an interesting nugget to chew on," he said. The deep divisions and tensions in the war cabinet with Powell, the moderate negotiator, and Rumsfeld, the hardline activist, meant no real policy would be made until either the president stepped in or events forced his hand. No one realized that better than Condoleezza Rice. At 46, she had a PhD in political science and had taught at Stanford, where she had risen to be provost. A Russian expert, she had been on the National Security Council staff in the presidency of Bush Sr. Graceful and tall, with an outgoing smile, she had forged her relationship with George W. Bush during the 2000 campaign when she served as his chief foreign policy advisor. She is not married and has no immediate family. It seemed she was on call for the president 24 hours a day in her West Wing office. with him on trips abroad, at Camp David on weekends, or at his Texas ranch. She was the connective tissue with the principals. Tending to the president and his priorities was her primary goal. The September 11, 2001 terrorist attacks in New York and Washington that killed nearly 3,000 altered and defined the Bush presidency. CIA Director Tenet had explicitly warned Bush about the immediacy and seriousness of the bin Laden threat. Focusing on domestic issues and a giant tax cut, Bush had largely ignored the terrorism problem. "I didn't feel that sense of urgency," the president acknowledged later in an interview. "My blood was not nearly as boiling." The next day, in the inner circle of Bush's war cabinet, Rumsfeld asked if the terrorist attacks did not present an opportunity to launch against Iraq. 4 days later, in an exhaustive debate at Camp David, none of the president's top advisors recommended attacking Iraq as a first step in the terrorism war. Not even Vice President Cheney, who probably read where Bush was headed and said, "If we go after Saddam Hussein, we lose our rightful place as good guy." As a former chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Powell was direct with one of his successors, Army General Hugh Shelton, in a private discussion after a National Security Council meeting. Powell had rolled his eyes at Shelton after Rumsfeld had raised Iraq as an opportunity. "What the hell? What are these guys thinking about?" Powell had asked Shelton. "Can't you get these guys back in the box?" Shelton promised he was trying. The next afternoon, Sunday, September 16th, Bush told Rice that the first target of the war on terrorism was going to be Afghanistan. "We won't do Iraq now," the president said. "We're putting Iraq off, but eventually we'll have to return to that question." In an interview nearly 1 year later, President Bush said that in the immediate aftermath of September 11th, "There were some who discussed Iraq. That's out of the question at this point. I mean, I didn't need any briefings." He added, "Don, wisely, and I agreed with this, was looking for other places where we could show that the war on terror was global." Rumsfeld was the man who was insistent upon boots on the ground to change the psychology of how Americans viewed war. Rumsfeld wanted to make sure that the military was active in other regions. 2 years after 9/11, during an interview in his office in the White House residence, President Bush said, "September the 11th obviously changed my thinking a lot about my responsibility as president. Because September the 11th made the security of the American people the priority, a sacred duty for the president, it changed his attitude toward Saddam Hussein's capacity to create harm," he said, adding that all his terrible features became much more threatening. "Keeping Saddam in a box looked less and less feasible to me." "Saddam was a madman," the president said. "He had used weapons of mass destruction in the past. He has created incredible instability in the neighborhood." Saddam had invaded Iran in the 1980s and Kuwait in the 1990s. Bush added, "The options in Iraq were relatively limited when you are playing the containment game." Cheney, the 61-year-old conservative hardliner, had already carved out a special position in the administration and held great sway with the president. Bush picked him to be his running mate in the summer of 2000 with these words, "If times are good, I'm going to need your advice, but not nearly as much as if times are bad." Given Cheney's background in national security going back to the Ford years, his time on the House Intelligence Committee, and as Secretary of Defense, Bush said at the top of his list of things he wanted Cheney to do was intelligence. With the president's full knowledge and encouragement, Cheney became the self-appointed examiner of worst-case scenarios. He felt they had to be prepared to think about the unthinkable. Cheney thought that the Clinton administration had failed in its response to terrorist acts, going back to the first World Trade Center bombing in 1993. After 9/11, it was clear to Cheney that the threat from terrorism had changed and grown enormously. So two matters would have to change. First, the standard of proof would have to be lowered. Smoking gun, irrefutable evidence would not have to be required for the United States to act to defend itself. Second, defense alone wasn't enough. They needed an offense. The most serious threat now facing the United States was a nuclear weapon or a biological or chemical agent in the hands of a terrorist inside the country's borders, and everything, in his view, had to be done to stop it. By November 21, 2001, when he took Rumsfeld aside, Bush had decided it was time to turn to Iraq. In dealing with Don Rumsfeld on this issue, the point I was making to him was at the time, show me what you have in place in case something were to happen. And we had already been through this exercise once, in Afghanistan. Bush said he knew it was a big step and that it entailed preparing the country and the world for war. I have no idea what it takes to cause the Pentagon to respond to a request since I've never been there. I presume Don Rumsfeld was making sure that the product got done and the process didn't linger. The president knew his man. The president was focused on the Iraq war plan, and when the president was focused, Rumsfeld was focused. Much of the year he had been casting about. He had hit pay dirt months before when he had begun asking to see the actual details for fighting specific wars. Let me see the Korean War plan, Rumsfeld ordered soon after he became secretary. The isolated, brutal, and militaristic regime of North Korea, headed by leader Kim Jong-il, was thought by many to be the next potential hotspot and the most dangerous threat. I was stunned, Rumsfeld later recalled in an interview. It was years out of date and focused on the mechanics of transporting large numbers of troops to the region. The plan also had not taken into account that the United States had a new president, Bush, and a new Secretary of Defense. They had different ideas and strategies. He was appalled. Did North Korea have nuclear weapons or not? Rumsfeld wanted to know. Were they assuming the North Koreans were 1 year away from having nukes? Again, there were no real answers. The plan provided no options, no intermediate solutions. The choices were, would you like to use rhetoric, or would you like to bring in 75 sledgehammers to beat that gnat into the ground? It was either diplomacy or total war. So on a Saturday in early August 2001, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the director of the Operational Plans staff and all his section chiefs appeared in Rumsfeld's office. Of the 68 war plans, fewer than 10 were massive, fully developed plans such as those for Korea, Iraq, and a few other potential hotspots. The rest were smaller contingency plans for civilian evacuations or for defending key areas such as the Panama Canal. Rumsfeld recalled the scene 2 years later. They were just briefing what was on the shelf. And it was an old, dusty shelf going back 4 or 5 years in some cases. I said, look, we've got to do two things. We owe the country and the president war plans, contingency plans, thinking that is current. And the only way we're going to get that is if we can compress that process dramatically and shorten it from years down to some cycle that it can be refreshed with current assumptions. There was a convergence with Rumsfeld's hurry-up agenda on war planning and the lessons of 9/11 as he saw them. The key thought about this is that you cannot defend against terrorism. You can't defend at every place at every time against every technique. You have to go after them, and you have to take it to them, and that means you have to preempt them. This was 4.5 months before Bush formally announced his preemption doctrine. Rumsfeld was thinking of a future when the U.S. should be ready to strike first. Rumsfeld's way was clear, and he was precise about it. The only way these things can be done well is if risk is elevated. He was willing to assume risk by planning to use less force. No one at the lower levels, the colonels, would embrace risk. They would add another division to a plan, some 20,000 troops, just to be sure. After the Saturday review session was over, Rumsfeld pronounced his verdict. That is insane. That is crazy. The war plans were improperly designed. Either it's world peace or it's World War III. Either the switch is off or on. Though he was trying to fix all the major war and contingency plans, after the president asked about the Iraq plan, Rumsfeld shifted into high gear. It at a certain point became much more intense, he said, and it had the highest priority. 6 days after the president's request on the Iraq war plan, Rumsfeld flew to see General Franks at his headquarters in Tampa. "Pull the Iraq planning out and let's see where we are," Rumsfeld told Franks when they were alone. The existing Iraq war plan, the mammoth top-secret document Op Plan 1003, outlined an attack and invasion of Iraq designed to overthrow the regime of Saddam Hussein. It was, Franks thought, the classic kind of plodding, tank-heavy, big-bomb massing of military might from another era. Just the thing that drove Rumsfeld nuts. "Let's put together a group that can just think outside the box completely," Rumsfeld ordered. After the meeting, Rumsfeld and Franks appeared before the news media to brief on the ongoing Afghanistan war called Operation Enduring Freedom. "How much of it, frankly, is a surprise?" one reporter asked, referring to the quick close in Afghanistan. "I think that what was taking place in the earlier phases was exactly as planned," Rumsfeld said. "It looked like nothing was happening. Indeed, it looked like we were in a," and he asked the room to join in, "all together now, quagmire." There was scattered laughter. Rumsfeld knew that they really hadn't had a plan for Afghanistan, had made it up under great pressure and uncertainty after September 11th. Iraq would be different. He wasn't going to be caught short, unprepared, and uninvolved. An impatient Rumsfeld wanted the first formal presentation on the Iraq war plan from Franks on December 4th at the Pentagon. Franks and his operations chief, Renouard, came to Rumsfeld's Pentagon office. "The reason the existing Iraq plan was important," Franks noted, "was because it was all they had." Rumsfeld wanted some alternatives and options. How could they minimize the amount of time between the moment the president might be forced to make a decision on war and when military operations could begin? The mission in an Iraq war was clear: change the regime, overthrow Saddam, eliminate the threats associated with him, the weapons of mass destruction, the terrorist ties, the danger he posed to his neighbors, especially Israel. Rumsfeld wanted the latest and best intelligence on the Iraqi military. This time, Franks was given 8 days to come back with more, and on December 12th, he and Renouart returned. Franks addressed two key questions. Are there efficiencies in how they might create a more robust force in a shorter period of time? Could they use less force? Rumsfeld thought yes to both, but he had more questions. "Will it all be visible?" he asked. "What were the things they could get away with without letting Saddam know?" Then he had one more thought. "You need to look at things that you could even do as early as April or May." That was 4 or 5 months away. The suggestion took Renouart's breath away. The thought of starting a war against Iraq in the spring was daunting. Later, Rumsfeld recalled during an interview in his Pentagon office, "I tend to ask a lot of questions of the people I work with, and I tend to give very few orders. This place is so big and so complicated, and there's so much that I don't know that I probe and probe and probe and push and ask, well, why wasn't this done, or shouldn't this be done? But it's generally with a question mark at the end." Rumsfeld certainly had to be aware that when the Secretary of Defense asks, "Why wasn't this done? Or shouldn't this be done?" or shows even the slightest discontent, it has the force of an order, even if concluded with a sincere question mark. "The president wants you to come to Crawford," Rumsfeld told Franks after their latest briefing on December 19th. Bush was spending the holidays at his 1,600-acre ranch in Crawford, Texas. "I won't go unless you go," Frank said, half tongue-in-cheek, but knowing that Rumsfeld was fierce about the chain of command. "Well, I'll see," Rumsfeld replied. Rumsfeld talked to the president and called Franks back with a surprising order. "The president wants you to come out there by yourself." In late November, the British Secret Intelligence Service, MI6, passed on to Washington the result of an elaborate intelligence operation it was running in Pakistan. A Pakistani nuclear weapons designer had offered to sell the crude design of a bomb to British agents who appeared to be tied to extremists or a radical Islamic country. At one point, the scientist drew a much more sophisticated design of a nuclear weapon. Included was information on building a crude radiological weapon, or dirty bomb. To top this off, bin Laden himself had told a Pakistani journalist recently that he had chemical and nuclear weapons as a deterrent. It was an electric moment when all this came together for the president. Bush told Tenet, "George, I want you to go over there and get what you need. Get on your plane and fly to Pakistan immediately. Pull out all the stops." Within hours, Tenet was halfway around the world. "I can't say to my president," Tenet told the Pakistani intelligence chief, "that there isn't a nuclear weapon in the United States. If there is and it goes off, it will be your fault." Tenet met with Pakistani President General Pervez Musharraf to convey the same message, peeling back the eyeballs of the demure, westernized, English-speaking general as much as possible. Tenet insisted the Pakistanis go 24/7 on the case and explore every angle, turn over every rock and scientist. 4 months later, a senior CIA official said the agency didn't find what we feared in Afghanistan, but is it somewhere else? I don't think we're to the bottom of this yet. The fear never went away, and the president and his National Security Council had to wrestle with the possibility of an attack that would be on such a scale that 9/11 would be a footnote to the history of the era. In this context, it was difficult to determine what was an overreaction. After all, hijacked passenger aircraft flown into buildings as missiles to kill thousands had seemed unreal before 9/11. The morning of Friday, December 28th, the president rose at 5 a.m. at his Crawford, Texas ranch and spent some time with his wife, Laura. Their place is a small, very modern, even spare ranch-style house on a man-made lake. Except for the various trappings of the presidency, security, and stewards who cook and serve, it might be a well-decorated weekend retreat for a wealthy couple. Bush had just read Theodore Rex by Edmund Morris, a glowing portrait of President Teddy Roosevelt and his big-stick diplomacy of the early 20th century. Even a casual reader of the 555-page text, even one inclined to skim, as Bush might have been, could not miss the message. Teddy Roosevelt dominated and defined his era by exercising presidential power decisively. Normally, Bush would have gone for a run of 3 or 4 miles, but a visitor was coming early. The president went to a special building on his ranch called a skiff, Sensitive Compartmented Information Facility, where he could be given sensitive briefings in person or by secure video links. General Tommy Franks and Major General Renouard joined the president in the secure video conference room. On screens were Cheney from his Wyoming vacation home, Rumsfeld from his Taos, New Mexico retreat, and Condi Rice, Powell, and Tenet from Washington. Franks, who had just been to Afghanistan, gave a summary of operations there. Since the first phase of the Afghanistan campaign had been won, he was accorded the respect of a victorious general by the members of the War Cabinet. Then he turned to the principal reason for the meeting that day, the Iraq war planning. "Mr. President," Franks said, "we have a lot to do on this thing, but let me show you where we are with this right now." He handed the president a paper copy of 26 briefing slides. Each was inscribed in stark red with the classification Top Secret / Polo Step. The plan was nothing less than a new concept for a war with Iraq, one which might be executed as a preemptive strike. Lines of operations would be the key. These were things the military, the CIA, and even the diplomats could do to apply pressure on Iraq. Each line of operation would be separate, but taken together they would create a critical mass that would reduce the amount of conventional combat power that would be needed. And in what he considered a breakthrough, Franks planned to array these lines of operations against what he called slices of the Iraqi regime's capability or vulnerability. These were the centers of gravity in Saddam's government. Franks had nine, including the leadership, the real inner circle of Saddam and his two sons, Uday and Qusay, the weapons of mass destruction infrastructure, the Republican Guard divisions, and the special Republican Guard that protected Baghdad, and internal security, including the close-in ring of bodyguards in the SSO, the Special Security Organization. Overall, Frank said this approach could avoid the long, drawn-out buildup of moving massive numbers of force to the region, so an attack could start with less notice and less force. On the other hand, beginning too soon could leave them with too little force. The president was taken with the concept that force could be applied selectively and carefully across the different slices. He saw that it was possible to create and capitalize on Iraqi vulnerabilities more efficiently if military and other power were combined in the right way. Franks turned to the basing and staging support from other countries that would be necessary for a war. What could they realistically expect? Franks said that for a bilateral attack with the participation of the United Kingdom, they would need at least four other countries for basing and overflight operations: Kuwait, Bahrain, Qatar, and Oman. In a unilateral operation without UK forces, Franks indicated that they would still have to have Kuwait, Qatar, and Oman, all but Bahrain. Thoughts on timing was the title of the next slide. A close reading of Frank's complete list would fix a possible start date for combat operations at 4 to 6 months from then, conceivably sometime between April and June 2002. The ingenious list put the president and the others on notice of exactly what would be required or expected from the region, the State Department, the CIA, Europe, and the president himself. Finally, on the last slide, Franks asked, "Where do we go from here?" "When you get to the point, Mr. President, of wanting or believing you might consider doing this," Franks said, treading carefully, "you have to allow us to increase the human intelligence activity in the country." Ticking through the list of pre-war actions again in sequential order, he said, "We've got to develop and provide substance to the opposition groups within Iraq. We need to begin this influence operation, and we need to start to enhance both our ground force and our air capacity under cover of the Afghanistan operation and the enforcement of the no-fly zones. Finally, we want to start now to move the equipment out of pre-positioned storage in Qatar to create space to allow CENTCOM, Central Command Headquarters, to move in." "Don," the president said, "we need to start doing some of these things." To Tommy Franks, he said, "This is good work. Keep grinding on it." The president said he could see that some things had to start. He was particularly caught up with the CIA piece, having watched the agency's covert relationships with opposition groups and leaders in Afghanistan, particularly the Northern Alliance, speed the course of that war. Tenet put the brakes on. Iraq was very different, he said. The CIA had had relationships with the various opposition groups in Iraq over the years, the Kurds in the north, the Shiites in the south. The consequences had been disastrous because the groups and individuals had been abandoned. Bush told Powell and Rumsfeld that they would have to work the political part. "We've got to work the nations in the region," the president said. "Develop a strategy for me on how best to do that." Rice had a question. What would happen if Saddam took his forces and pulled back into Baghdad to make a last stand, creating a fortress that we would have to fight through? "That's something we're going to have to focus more on in our planning to preclude it from happening," Frank said. Cheney had a major concern. We're going to have to look really hard at how we protect ourselves against the use of weapons of mass destruction, both in the field as well as in the rear. Yes, sir, Franks acknowledged. Then, addressing the president, he said, Now we're going to want to come back and talk to you about evolving this big plan, or linking this big plan to what you know, Mr. President, as Desert Badger. Bush had already been briefed on Desert Badger, which would allow him to order a small attack in 4 hours, either with U.S. aircraft or some 50 Tomahawk cruise missiles from Navy ships in the Persian Gulf. He now had modules he could pick from, including a rather substantial punishing series of strikes on Iraq targets of military significance, up to and including suspected production sites for Iraqi missiles. Just before 10 a.m., Bush, in a casual ranch outfit of jeans, shirt, and boots, and Franks with his high-top combat boots and beret, stepped out for a press briefing. All the questions were about bin Laden, Afghanistan, and the recent collapse of Enron, the Texas-based energy trading company. Asked about the coming new year, Bush said, I hope 2002 is a year of peace, but I am also realistic. Bush then drove Franks on a long tour of his ranch. Afterward, they stopped at the main house to visit with Laura Bush. Both Franks and Laura are from Midland, Texas, and had gone to the same high school but did not know each other. The president invited Franks and Renouard to stay for lunch. No, Mr. President, said Franks. I need to get back. On the flight back to Tampa, Renouard complained that Franks should have agreed to stay for lunch. Boss, Renouard said, you're not feeding us on the way home here. So they had soft drinks and peanuts while sharing their excitement. They were pleased that the president seemed to understand the complexity and the time problems, that this wasn't going to happen tomorrow. I think he got it, Renouard said. We have made a start, Franks replied. I want to know what my options are as the president, Bush said 2 years later in an interview, explaining how he had approached this first briefing on Iraq war plans. He knew his Secretary of Defense well, and Rumsfeld wouldn't have gone ahead if he hadn't been satisfied himself with the progress. They've got the process to a point where he feels comfortable bringing Franks forward, Bush recalled. So he had been most interested in reading Franks. I'm trying to figure out what intelligent questions to ask a commander who has just impressed me in Afghanistan. I'm looking for the logic. I'm watching his body language very carefully, Bush recalled. He emphasized the body language, the eyes, the demeanor. It was more important than some of the substance. It was also why he wanted Franks there in Crawford and not as another face on a wall of screens. Is this good enough to win? He recalled asking Franks, leaning forward in his chair and throwing his hand forward in a slicing motion at my face to illustrate the scene. Absolutely, it was, Franks had answered, but the plan could get better. We weren't ready to execute then, the president said. I mean, we're not even close. But he left the briefing with two things on his mind. Saddam's a threat. This is an option. At the beginning of 2002, CIA Director George Tenet's stock with the president was way up. His covert action program for sending CIA paramilitary teams into Afghanistan had provided the initial contacts and strategy for driving the Taliban from power. At 48, Tenet was the only high-level Clinton holdover on the Bush National Security Team. High-strung, focused, and an extremely talented briefer, Tenet, the son of Greek immigrants, knew the importance of forging personal relationships. Everything is mano a mano, everything, he once said. Most importantly, he had bonded with President Bush, whom he personally briefed in the Oval Office most days at 8 a.m. I like him, Bush said, and I trust him, which is more important. Even before 9/11, Tenet had seen Iraq was going to be an important concern for the Bush administration. One of the key behind-the-scenes posts for the CIA would be the person who would run covert action against Saddam. Tenet made it clear to the chain of command in the agency that he wanted a hardcore, tough son of a bitch. Saul, not his real name, was a star in the CIA's clandestine service. At 43, balding with a short, perfectly trimmed beard and a fireplug build, he had worked for years in sensitive undercover posts as a case officer and senior operator in CIA stations around the world. In 2001, Saul was looking around for a job at CIA headquarters in Langley. Within the CIA's Near East Division, the Chief Iraqi Operations Group post was opening up. It was viewed as a career killer. Iraqi operations was referred to as the House of Broken Toys. It was largely populated with new green officers and problem officers, or old boys waiting for retirement. Saul asked for the job. He thought the Bush administration might get serious about Iraq. He'd heard some rumblings. He started on August 4, 2001. The National Security Council had asked the CIA what it could do on Iraq. So Saul set about a full scrub or review of the past. The House of Broken Toys was more than a people problem, Saul quickly learned. Past operations read almost like a handbook for failed and stupid covert action. The comic mixed with the frightening. During the Clinton administration, one absurd broken toy operation included dropping leaflets in Baghdad to mock Saddam on his birthday. Saul brought together a group of seasoned covert operators and analysts from the Directorate of Intelligence to review the past. The central question, how do we view covert action in Iraq? Saul reached a conclusion that covert action is not going to remove Saddam Hussein. The CIA had to face the reality that Saddam, in power since 1979, had erected a nearly perfect security apparatus to protect himself and stop a coup. Looking at the overall U.S. policy, he saw a glaring contradiction. Through the United Nations, the U.S. was working to contain